This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A dispute between Maui County and a local environmental group is heading to the Supreme Court. The High Court announced Monday it would hear a case that involved discharge from a wastewater treatment plant in Lahaina. HPR's Ryan Finnerty tells us about that depending on the income, it could change the way water pollution is regulated by the federal government.
The Cuyahoga River in Ohio is so loaded with the waste products of petroleum distillation that it is actually in danger of catching fire.
In 1969, that's exactly what happened. The Cuyahoga River in Cleveland became so polluted that it burst into flames. This wasn't the first time Cleveland had seen a river fire, but the 1969 blaze fueled the budding national conservation movement. In 1972, Congress passed the Clean Water Act, overriding a veto by President Richard Nixon. It established water quality standards and created a structure for the federal government to regulate pollutants. The act bans dumping those pollutants directly into surface water sources, like rivers and lakes, but not groundwater. A court case from Hawaii may soon change that.
For years, it's been known that when the facility discharges from its injection wells into the groundwater directly beneath the facility, that millions of gallons of treated sewage get into the ocean each day.
That's David Henkin, an attorney with the environmental law firm Earth Justice. He's representing four Maui-based groups that are suing Maui County over the discharge from a wastewater treatment plant in Lahaina.
There have been massive algal outbreaks on the reef at Kahikili. There has been massive die-off of a once pristine reef, and this is largely due to the millions of gallons of treated sewage from the Lahaina facility.
The Lahaina Wastewater Reclamation Facility is located about 2 miles upslope of downtown Lahaina in West Maui. It first came online in 1975, and until the recent court ruling was not covered by the Clean Water Act. That's because the Clean Water Act only regulates discharge into surface water. The Lahaina facility injects treated wastewater back into the ground. Groundwater isn't covered by the Clean Water Act. But the situation changed in 2012.
Undebatable evidence that the wastewater was reaching from those wells to the coastline.
That's Craig Glenn, a geologist from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. The state of Hawaii and the EPA asked Glenn to determine whether or not the treated wastewater being injected into the ground was reaching the ocean.
The very first thing I did was run something that I personally specialize in, is using aerial infrared photography from aircraft to look for what we call submarine groundwater discharge. Fresh water, because it's colder than seawater, when it leaks into the ocean, it appears as a cold water anomaly. And it's also, it floats on the surface of the seawater. Because it's fresh water, it's buoyant and it floats on top of the seawater. We did the flights and we found a very large thermal anomaly. And then we mixed tracer dyes and poured them down the injection wells that the wastewater treatment plant was using. And then nearly daily monitoring that took place for quite a long time. We even started before we did the injection dye, so we knew what the background was like, et cetera. These dyes are detectable in very small quantities, parts per billions, basically. And we started seeing the dye concentrations rise and rise and rise.
As surface water, the ocean is covered by the Clean Water Act. The proven connection between the wastewater plant and the ocean provided the basis for the current lawsuit. The Hawaii Wildlife Fund is the lead plaintiff in the case. Hannah Bernard is the director and co-founder of the Maui-based organization.
There had been suspicion that these waters getting into the reef wouldn't be good and might cause an impact.
A 2006 survey from the Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources deepened those suspicions. The survey found a roughly 25% decline in existing coral cover on West Maui reefs over a 12-year period.
People who are ocean users, we saw this study and we became alarmed. And we wanted to investigate and have more information about the possibility of, can we do something to mitigate this? And so we started organizing meetings and sharing the information and talking about it. And then we got in touch with our EPA. Actually, we organized public meetings with the EPA here several times.
The EPA was working with Maui County to address the impact of the injection wells when the groundwater dye study was published in 2012. That was when Bernard's group decided to sue, alleging a violation of the Clean Water Act. They initially won in federal court, and again when Maui County appealed the decision. The case will now head to the Supreme Court. Earth Justice Attorney David Henkin says there's a reason the court decided to take on the case.
The reason that the court is likely taking this case is that there is one court of appeals, which is the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which decided a pair of cases out of Kentucky and Tennessee. And in those cases, that court of appeals said that the Clean Water Act does not require a permit if a discharge is via groundwater. In doing that, it directly disagreed with the decision in our case, which came out of the Ninth Circuit, which controls the western part of the United States, and the Fourth Circuit, which decided a case out of South Carolina. So basically, there's what's called a circuit split. The Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit agree with us, and the Sixth Circuit agrees with the county. Only the Supreme Court, which makes decisions uniform national law across the country, only the Supreme Court can resolve the circuit split.
Maui County maintains that its practices at the Lahaina plant are safe. Here's County Communications Director Brian Perry reading a prepared statement.
Maui County welcomes the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to grant its petition for a hearing in its ongoing West Maui injection well case. We have a strong case to show that the county continues to protect the public's health and the environment through its use of facilities initially developed with EPA funding four decades ago and its robust recycled water program.
Maui County has challenged the idea that discharge from the Lahaina treatment plant is harming nearby oceans. In a published fact sheet, the county acknowledged the dye study but denied that discharge from the wastewater plant was responsible for algal blooms or coral death. The county also pointed out that previous court rulings did not address environmental damage. They instead issued the more narrow ruling that the Lahaina underground injection wells do require a Clean Water Act permit. The Hawaii Department of Health confirmed that the Lahaina wastewater facility does have an injection well permit on file and has also applied for a Clean Water Act permit. It did not confirm the status of that application or when it was submitted. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
The case Maui County versus Hawaii Wildlife Fund is scheduled to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court this fall. Acting EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler has opposed the expansion of waters covered under the Clean Water Act. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Magnolia Boutique and Gallery in Kahala Mall, offering original art from Hawaii artists and a collection of gifts and home accessories from around the world. Open daily.
We're looking for a pledge and listener experience producer. This dynamic team player will have the responsibility of producing our semi-annual fund drives and outreach activities. If you have a background in events coordination or broadcast production, with experience managing cross-functioning teams, check out the Employment Opportunities page on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Once upon a time, birds of a feather flocked together and flew to the Hawaiian Islands. Free from their natural enemies, they evolved into about 78 unique species. But then, well, humans arrived, and with us are pets, pigs, rats, and other ecosystem-altering animals. Today, Hawaii has more endangered species of birds and plants than anywhere else on the earth, and that's the bad news. The good news is that Hawaii established the first refuge in the country to save forest birds. Do you know the name of this refuge and where it is? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer to this two-part quiz. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Joshua Wish from the ACLU of Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
What to do about all our trash? For more than 30 years now, Hawaii County has been trying to find the best way forward after it finally closes the Hilo landfill. Our Big Island contributing reporter, Sherry Bracken, is on the line with the latest. Morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good, good. So get me up to speed. How does Hawaii County handle its garbage now?
Well, right now, Hawaii County has two landfills. One is Hilo that has been operational for more than 40 years, and then the other one is sort of hidden around the Waikoloa Resort area. It's called Pu'uanahulu, and garbage goes to there directly from trash haulers, but also from the transfer stations. The county has 22 transfer stations around the island, and people just take their garbage there. Unlike Oahu, which you have county garbage pickup, Hawaii County does not have any municipal garbage pickup, just because we are so big and so spread out, and there are some neighborhoods that do have garbage service provided by private haulers that are houses that are, you know, normally close together, but there's a lot of rural areas where there's no option other than just taking your trash to the transfer station. So it's a system, and it works, but the Hilo landfill, the first interview I did about the Hilo landfill was probably back in 2005, early in 2005, and at that time, the head of County Solid Waste said, it's running out of space, we're going to close it. So here we are in 2019, and now they are actually going to close it.
Do we have a date?
We do not have a date. The bid has just been put out to manage the closure, because when you close a landfill, you actually have to plan to manage it for at least 30 years. So the bid out, which will probably be around $20 million, the first step is stopping taking trash, and that'll happen within a few months, and then cover the landfill with something like AstroTurf, which is sort of a new technique. In fact, the Hilo landfill will be the first landfill in the whole state to be covered with an impermeable covering. So that's pretty significant. But so the first step is getting the bid from somebody to do something, stopping taking garbage within the next few months, and then getting on with the closure. And at that point, all the trash, which currently has been going to the Hilo landfill, will go to the Pu'uanahulu landfill.
So, boy, that's going to be really interesting. I mean, that's a lot of change for a lot of people.
You know, it really is not. The transfer stations, which is primarily where folks take their trash, they will still all be open. And there'll be a transfer station at the Hilo landfill. So anybody who takes their trash personally will have probably little change. The biggest change, I imagine, will be for the garbage haulers who may have been taking bigger loads to the Hilo landfill. But other than that, for, you know, the public's perception, the only other thing is that obviously the trash will be trucked from Hilo to the Pu'uanahulu landfill. It could go around through Waimea. It could go over Saddle Road, and that will be an issue. Although back in, I think it was Mayor Billy Kanoi's, the third year maybe of his first term, so it was several years ago, more than 10 years ago, they actually did some experiments trucking trash from the Hilo landfill to Pu'uanahulu just to see how much disruption it caused, to see what kind of complaints they got, and they got zero complaints. And then when people found out they had done this experiment, they were like, oh, my gosh, you didn't tell us. We would have complained.
Well, so, I was thinking about the traffic, you know, rerouting traffic, and you've got, you know, all the trucks whizzing by.
Yeah, and it's going to be probably around, and let me, I apologize for this. I think they told me 7 or 8 big trucks a day, but I will confirm that one. I did not write that down in my notes to talk to you about. But I get the sense it won't be that onerous, but we will just see, you know. But it's got to be done. There really is no question. You cannot have a landfill overflowing, and the state will not allow any expansion of the Hilo landfill. It's right near the Hilo airport, and the landfills attract birds, and that is a very bad thing to have attracted to an airport area. So there's no question the Hilo landfill is going to close.
And so what's the expected life of the other landfill?
Well, the Pu'uanahulu capacity, first of all, I have been there. The Hilo landfill is 40 acres, and it's gigantic. The Pu'uanahulu landfill, I was shocked when I went there. It's hidden up behind a hill, so you really cannot see it from the highway. And when I drove, it was like this endless landscape. It's huge. And the capacity is between 50 and 150 years. And you might say, gee, that's a really big range. And the biggest difference is if we in the county recycle and reuse, we can keep the landfill going for far longer a time. And Bill Kucharski, who is head of the Department of Environmental Management, and George Hidesco, the recycling coordinator, both of whom bring excellent backgrounds, and I think we're in very good hands with them, they both have stressed that recycling is a huge key. Green waste is our biggest recycle item, around 48 tons a year, and that is no longer going into the landfill in general. The county, though, is trying to get people to recycle more of their number one and number two plastics, their glass, and, you know, just to recycle everything that can be recycled and reuse things more and just be more mindful of not throwing things away. In the future, in about a year, we'll get a compost station. In the meantime, they do want people to try composting themselves.
I know various islands have tried different things with recycling. I believe there was a company on Maui that tried to do glass. And, you know, we're having our issues here on Oahu with the China situation, with them, you know, refusing to take a lot of U.S. litter. And I believe they were farming some of it out to, I think, Vietnam and Korea. But where does the Big Island recyclables, where do they go?
Well, same situation. China stopped taking number 5 plastics, so we can no longer recycle those at all, and they go into garbage. Our plastics 1 and 2 do go to Asia, to Vietnam, Korea, and Malaysia. But this is cool. Our used motor oil stays here on the island. There are recyclers who use it for energy. Our glass all stays here on the island. It's used, it's crushed up and used in landscaping. There's some newspaper that stays here on the island as packing for floral purposes, but otherwise all of that other recycled stuff does go to Asia. And if Asia, which is getting overwhelmed, stops, then it's not clear what will happen.
I know when we had Mayor Kim on the other week, we had callers kind of raise the flag for help as far as all the litter.
That is a big issue. And Mayor Kim told me in my first interview with him after he became mayor again this time that that was one of his biggest priorities, is litter. And Bill Kucharski, who is head of Department of Environmental Management, said they're going to start an education campaign to start with the kids, which will be good. And by the way, one of the biggest litter items we have right now is abandoned vehicles, because it's costing now $600 to $700 for somebody to turn in an abandoned vehicle. And so Kucharski says that they're thinking of doing an amnesty. But the regular small litter thing, it's unimaginable to most people. Why do you throw things out of your car? It doesn't make any sense.
Right. Malama the Aina, Malama the Aina.
Yeah.
I know we had talked about this abandoned car issue with the county council, and I believe, you know, the problem there is that they were having to deal with the cars on private property.
Well, I think that they have worked out a way to also tow off the cars off private property. You know, in the last several years, the number of abandoned vehicles has increased. I will tell you, the police are responsive, and the county has 2 towing companies, with whom they contract. And so if you do notify the police of an abandoned vehicle, it should be away, particularly if it's on a public street, for, you know, within a week, which is really good. I mean, the law says 10 days, but I personally have seen the police be really reactive to that. So that's good.
I know here on Oahu, we've been dealing with the issue of a lot of the vehicles left behind by military personnel. I know the city and county has been working with the military to try and resolve that issue. But do you folks have any of that at all?
No, because we just don't really have any permanently stationed military here. And if we did, I'm sure they could find a way to sell their car, because people are always buying cars here. I personally don't understand why somebody just abandons a car, because I spend way too much money on a car to just leave it someplace. But, you know, I get it that if you can't afford to fix it, that's what you might choose to do.
Right. And I know there is concern growing about the eyesore, and it's just not really good for the environment.
Well, and that's why Bill Kucharski said they're looking into doing an amnesty where people can just bring cars, bring your registration, make sure it's your car, turn it in, you know, no harm, no foul, to avoid just leaving it on a street, because that would be cheaper for the county in a way than to take up the time of the police and then contract with the towing companies to get rid of those vehicles.
And as far as the polystyrene ban, I know there's lots of talk about that.
That goes into effect in June, and there is lots of talk about that. And then people who get takeout will not be able to have polystyrene as the takeout, and we'll see what happens next with that. The thing is, there's still going to be polystyrene because people buy plates at stores to use for potlucks and such, but the intent is to try to cut down on those things which are not recyclable, and polystyrene does not disappear eventually in the environment, and it does not get recycled, and it can't be composted. So that's the goal here.
I know there's been some discussion about single-use straws. Have you wrestled with that issue over on the Big Island?
Well, it's obviously an issue everywhere, but there's been no publicity or no plan for it at this point.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Sherry. Appreciate you getting us up to speed.
Thank you. Lovely to talk with you. Aloha.
Aloha. That was our contributing reporter, Sherry Bracken, talking about the state of trash in Hawaii County. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providers of auto, home, commercial, and specialty lines of insurance since 1911. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
Visitor arrivals to Hawaii have broken records since 2012. But what effect has our state's number one industry had on Hawaii's culture and environment? A panel of experts consider how much tourism is too much in a public forum moderated by Catherine Cruz, presented by Zocalo Public Square and the Daniel K. Inouye Institute. Tonight at 6:30 at Artist Street, Honolulu in Kaka'ako. Free admission. Reservations at hprtickets.org.
Our shows featuring various state lawmakers have kept our phone lines busy. During David Ige's visit to our studios last month, we had to send many of you to our talkback line to share your concerns.
Hi, my name is Brittany from the Big Island of Hawaii. We currently don't have any small animal processing facility that is USDA certified. That means no local pork, lamb, or goat can enter the food system legally. What can we do to support our island farmers?
Aloha, it's Regina from the Big Island, Honaunau. I just want to comment regarding the fire ants and using dogs. It sounds like a good idea, but fire ants do cause blindness in dogs if they're exposed to them more than once. It's a real problem for folks over on the Hilo side that do have fire ants. I know folks that their dogs have gone blind from being exposed to having fire ants in their yard. It's just an important thing I'd like to say. I'd sure like to get rid of them, but I don't know if dogs is the way to go. Thank you so much.
My name is Julia Alos. I'm a resident of Waikoloa. How do we plan to prepare for the 2020 census with so many folks not being counted because they are in these resort areas, and we cannot count the heads in the beds because they live somewhere else. This impacts greatly on our police, fire, hospital funding, and schooling that we receive from the federal government. Tourists are already impacting the infrastructure and leave a huge footprint on what us taxpayers are paying for. Aloha.
Hi, this is Bruce Manoa, and there are commercial airlines that are flying over the Ko'olau's constantly, in addition to prop planes, helicopters, and military helicopters and transport jets. So those are all creating a lot of noise in the valley because it's like an amphitheater. In addition, the safety concerns, portion of the plane falls off for any reason or something, or if there's an emergency and it has to land and there's nowhere to land, those are all big safety concerns when it's flying over a residential area. I hear the residential areas that are also affected are Waimanalo, Kahala, Kaimuki, and of course Manoa. Thank you.
And Deb Boltz of Honolulu wrote in to say, I really appreciate the focus on our preschool population. This is essential if we're to achieve that level playing field. I do, however, need to add some of my thoughts. Early education should start earlier. The real sponge moment in time is 0 to 3 years. Many of our tiniest will already be 1 to 2 years behind if they start at age 3 or 4. Neighborhood schools need to become community learning centers for families. Comprehensive is the term that comes to mind. This includes opportunities that help caregivers. I ended my 37 years with DOE as a school counselor at Olomana School. It was a privilege. It gave me insights and understandings that caused me to ponder daily the reasons we are still missing our target. I know the answers are out there. We need to start asking the right questions. We thank you for your feedback, and if you want to weigh in on any of the segments we cover, email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on our Facebook page, The Conversation HPR, and on Twitter, we're at HSI Conversation, or call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Death trap at Diamond Head Crater. Well, that's the headline. Our reality check this morning has to do with safety and the growing number of visitors. Denby Fawcett, columnist for Honolulu Civil Beat, is on the line with us to talk about the article that she wrote for the online site. Morning, Denby.
Morning, Catherine.
So tell us about this story. I know you're an avid hiker at Diamond Head. You wrote a book about it, but what's this latest concern with the entrance
there
at Diamond Head?
The concern is a concern that's been there always, and that's the crowded tunnel that pedestrians have to enter when they want to go into the crater. And it's just become exacerbated now because so many more people are going into Diamond Head. And for example, this Christmas Day, a record 4,507 pedestrians walked into the crater. And on top of that, another 1,200 vehicles. So this is just like an astounding number they have never seen there before. And it's continuing on in high numbers. They're normally used to 3,000 visitors, which is high already.
Well, I know the last time I was there over the holidays, you know, I drove in to drop my daughter off for the hike. But it just makes me nervous as a driver going through there, you know, much less a pedestrian.
Yes, it's nerve-wracking for the drivers because there are only two narrow lanes. And then for the pedestrian, there's only a path on one side of the tunnel that's only 5 feet wide. So you have two-way pedestrian traffic going on that tiny lane. And when it gets crowded sometimes, pedestrians go out into the traffic lane, which is, you know, horrifically dangerous, but they're so squished and crowded. And this is kind of like a little microcosm of what's happening all over Hawaii with so many tourists coming to places that were never intended for 4,000 and 5,000 tourists coming in a day.
Right, and we are having the discussions now about over-tourism, but your article has a number of pictures, you know, showing how people are just kind of like up with their backs against the wall as these huge whether they're the trolleys or the large buses come through there. So it is pretty nerve-wracking.
Yes, and that tunnel was built in 1942, and the intention was never for thousands of tourists to be walking through it, as well as these huge tour buses, which weren't even invented then. The tunnel was built by the Army right after the Pearl Harbor attack, and the intent was to build a new battery up on the south side of Diamond Head to, in case the Japanese came back again. So this is a very historic feature, but its intention was never to be a tourist entryway.
Well, we've heard a lot about the master plan for Diamond Head for such a long time. So where are we at as far as actually getting things moving?
Well, I think their urgency is here now. I think the hugest wake-up call was that Christmas Day horde of people that came in. And in the master plan, there are three phases, but the first and most important phase is to prohibit pedestrians from the Kahala Tunnel, the one way the public goes into Diamond Head now, and move them up to a tunnel, the Kapuhulu Tunnel, which is just up off Makapu Drive. And that's the only other entrance into the crater. And the military, the State Department of Defense, is poised to turn that tunnel over to the state. It no longer needs it. And I think now that it would be in the best interest of everyone if they sped that up. And the governor and his executive budget even has money to make that happen, to help that with the construction that would be needed for that change.
All right. Well, let's hope they move quickly on this. Thanks so much, Denby.
You're welcome, Catherine.
That was columnist Denby Fawcett with today's Reality Check. To read her story, visit civilbeat.org. And we should mention that tonight HPR is taking part in a forum on overtourism along with Zocalo and the Daniel K. Inouye Institute. That event takes place tonight at the Artistry in Kaka'ako and starts at 6:30 p.m.
This is Chris Dodds from First Hawaiian Bank. We have been a proud corporate underwriter because we believe HPR's programming enriches the quality of life for all of us in Hawaii. Many of HPR's active and concerned listeners are also our bank customers. Our support is in recognition of the mutual values of trusted integrity and quality that we share with HPR and demonstrates First Hawaiian's solid commitment to our community.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Following the high-profile DUI collision killing three pedestrians and injuring five people in Kaka'ako, Mayor Kirk Caldwell this week unveiled a package of measures to increase pedestrian safety on Oahu.
We're going to require that there be stencils placed on major intersections where accidents have occurred, saying, look all ways. It's to remind people, pedestrians, to empower yourself. Before you step into the street, don't assume that you're going to be seen, because unfortunately, you're not seen and you're hit. So stop and don't cross until you've looked all ways.
Deputy Director for Transportation Services Don Ouchi talked about working on the draft Oahu pedestrian plan that's due out this summer.
It is really a wholesale opportunity for the public to weigh in on how do we create safer spaces for our pedestrians, whether they be regular sidewalks, separated paths, or any other opportunities we might have to just create a better pedestrian environment, a better walkable city. You know, we do have a lot of cars on this small island, but we can't forget that everyone is a pedestrian. Even people who drive, they're a pedestrian before they get in their cars. So that pedestrian plan will contemplate how do we create the best spaces in our limited urban environment here in Honolulu.
And on the draft plan at the city's website, Mayor Caldwell also outlined two of his pedestrian safety measures at the legislature, the No Right Turn on Red Bill and the Red Light Photo Enforcement Bill.
You may ask, why are we going to the state legislature? Why isn't the city and county of Honolulu just do it on their own? And part of the reason is that we control just city streets. The state controls state streets, and many of our city streets cross state streets. To most people, streets are streets they don't know. And so we wanted to make it uniform for all the intersections in terms of right hand on red. It's another way to get people to talk about what are we going to do to prevent more accidents involving pedestrians from occurring. The second one is red light photo enforcement. Again, we could do it at just city intersections, but again, there's a lot of state-city interaction, and some of the most deadly places are in those areas. Unfortunately, on the House side, the bill was not moved forward. saying somehow that we need a pilot, that we need to think small, that, you know, we don't know if it's going to work. Red light photo enforcement exists in 388 other communities around our country. This is not something new. It's not a pioneering effort. It was in existence when my wife was chair of the FDIC under Clinton. And we lived with that in D.C. And when you ever visit D.C., people are very careful about running a red light because they take your picture. You get a ticket in the mail. If you want to contest it, just like a parking ticket, you can. But most people don't because they're caught in the act of running a red light.
And Senate Bill 663 was passed by the Senate Ways and Means Committee yesterday. It allows counties to create a red light camera program. Honolulu is ranked number one nationally for senior 65 and older being at risk for pedestrian fatality. New PSAs will roll out in the coming weeks, and the public will also see 100 new bollards glued to the road, reminding drivers to slow down for pedestrians. Following successful pilot projects in Waianae and Waimanalo, orange flags will be placed at various intersections. Pedestrians hold up the bright flags to alert drivers to their presence in crosswalks. The Honolulu City Council has introduced a resolution to work closely with the Caldwell administration on safety measures. Bill 83 allows drivers to utilize hazard lights to acknowledge pedestrians in crosswalks. HPD will also be beefing up DUI checkpoints and roving patrols. Impaired drivers who are caught will face increased consequences. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Francine Wai from the Disability and Communication Access Board. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Since the arrival of humans in Hawaii, as many as 95 species of native birds have become extinct, and 33 species of endemic birds are under the protection of the Endangered Species Act. Sadly, Hawaii has one of the highest concentrations of vulnerable species of birds and plants. And earlier in the show, we asked you to name the first refuge in the country dedicated to protecting and rare forest birds and habitats. Established in 1985, the Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge is located on the windward slopes of Mauna Kea and on the western slope of Mauna Loa. The reserve used to be open to the public. However, since the appearance of the fungus-causing rapid ohia death disease, the refuge remains closed to the public. Currently, this important habitat is home to substantial populations of four of the seven endangered forest birds living on the Big Island. This includes the Hawaii creeper, the Hawaiian hawk, and the Hawaiian hoary bat. It also protects several endangered plants. Congratulations to Parker from Volcano. You got the right answer. And that's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's coming up on 2 weeks since the storm downed trees in Waikiki, including one at the Honolulu Zoo, which allowed two rare birds to fly the coop. Zoo staff were able to lure one of the two African ground hornbill birds back to safety. Honolulu Zoo Director Linda Santos joins us live with an update. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I just worry about that other bird. You know, when I am out there by Diamond Head and Kapi'olani Park, I'm looking out for him. So what's the latest?
So we have active sightings, and one of the people that called in is actually a credible sighting, and it was one of the park's keepers by the tennis courts, and they actually photographed the bird, and so we know he's still out there, and we go out there every day and do a search for the bird. We haven't actually laid eyes on him ourselves. But we've had people call in and say they've got a glimpse of him over by the tennis courts.
Okay, so he's close by.
Yeah, he is close by, and we're really pleased because the first picture we had by a visitor was taken at the top of Diamond Head.
Oh, my. Wow. So, yeah. But this area then by the tennis courts, I mean, that's kind of near where you found Martha. And so is it possible that Najuma is just, you know, hanging out there and will make his way back too?
That's what we're hoping. But we want to make sure we get eyes on him and make sure he's capable of either making it back or if we can lure him down with food. We do know that he probably has eaten either insects, geckos, rodents, or whatever he's catching out there, because obviously he's still looking pretty good, according to witnesses' high accounts. And so we're hoping we can bait him down with food. He is a male ground hornbill, and they tend to be more independent, so it may be more of a difficult bird to lure down and get back. It may take us a little longer.
I think I remember at the press conference with your zoo staff, they were saying that I think Martha had kind of this homing instinct. So
yes.
not so much with Najuma then.
No, not so much with Najuma. He is, you know, part of a tight family unit, so that's really important. And I think he is going to be looking for other hornbills. And our Martha and Abby, who's the older male that's still in the temporary cage, call every morning. So we're hoping that at some point he'll hear that, and that'll kind of point him in the right direction as to making his way back. But we really would like to get eyes on him and see if we can lure him down.
Is there any way to use those calls, either to have a tape of it and play it on a loudspeaker so that he hears it?
Oh, we've done that, and we've done it by the tennis courts, and then that's ironically where he showed up the next day.
Oh, there you go.
So we go out. We have a little speaker on a Bluetooth, and we play hornbill calls. We've utilized the shell to try and blast it out. And so, you know, we've tried everything to get him into the area. So we're just pleased that people are calling in and giving us sightings and telling us what tree they've seen him in, because that's very helpful for us. It's very helpful if they can photograph him so we know it's a credible sighting and, you know, what time they saw him, so we kind of have an idea of his movement.
And if I recall, he's used to having dinner around 3 o'clock.
Yes. He is used to having dinner around 3 o'clock. So we're normally out in the park first thing in the morning, and then we go out in midday and afternoon, and we talk to a lot of the people at the tennis courts or the parks keepers, and they're on the lookout. There's a lot of regulars that play tennis, and so there's a flyer that we provided them with all the information. Urban Forestry, who's right next door currently, is also on the lookout. So we have a lot of people that are helping us trying to get eyes on him.
You talk about the trees. I know when I passed by Kapi'olani Park the other day, they made pretty good progress removing those trees that fell over. What about the one in the zoo?
Yeah, we've already removed our tree, and so we have to look at bringing, you know, they don't sell that type of wire on island, so we have to order new mesh to restore the exhibit. But they're in a pretty big cage down at the bird department
further
in the zoo.
But as far as the aviary that will have to be rebuilt, do you have enough wiggle room in your budget, you know, emergency money to deal with that, or do you have to go out to bid, and is that going to take a while?
It shouldn't have to go out to bid. That was built with our staff in-house. So it's not a substantial. Bird aviaries don't take a lot. It's normally pole with wire and netting. So it's not a substantial repair, although the sidewalk in front of it will be more of a substantial repair.
Yes, I saw those pictures. I mean, yeah. I was down there, so I saw them, but we have pictures on our website. That's pretty incredible, the damage that it did.
Yeah, it just uprooted everything and just fell on the aviary.
So is urban forestry going out and kind of checking all our trees in the park and in the zoo just to see if there are any others that are vulnerable?
Yeah, we have a horticulturist, Sebastian, and so he's been working with an arborist to identify which trees may be a hazard. So that's something we had started before the storm, and we've actually removed some of the worst ones already.
Okay, well, that's good. Good for everybody's safety.
Yeah.
I know there was some concern because, you know, we have had some escapes, you know, within the zoo proper from some of the other animals, I think a chimpanzee, and there are other things over the years. But I'm sure this was a good time to kind of reassess and remind everybody what the procedures are for a rapid response if someone does get loose.
Oh, yeah. We go through annual training, and we have to do drills. And, you know, so that's part of our policy and SOP for our staff. They all have a role if something gets out. So they're trained to respond. And the big thing, the first thing we want to do is containment. Obviously, it's a lot more difficult when you have something that flies because containment, you know, you can't keep up. So we rely highly on the homing effect. And so anything that has gotten out, we normally get it back pretty quick.
Well, I did have to chuckle at the video that's been making social media. You know, your staff was trying so hard, and I remember seeing it as I was driving by, and I was like, holy cow, they're out there with these giant nets.
Yeah. Yeah. They actually was trying to tire her out, getting her moving from tree to tree, because once they get tired, they don't fly. So they thought if they tired her out, then they could slow her down and possibly actually net her, but she definitely outsmarted them and went home on her own, so we're very happy.
Right, and I know there is always a concern that if a different type of animal gets out and then there's public safety that's an issue, but I'm sure all those steps are pretty much outlined as part of the whole accreditation process, right?
Yes, you have to have a capture team, a shooting team for public safety. Our staff is highly trained for containment, and there's several methods of containment because a lot of our exhibits have double doors or double gates before you can actually get in or out. So it's just, you know, a matter of things like primates that can climb or birds that can take flight. That would be the higher risk for us.
And I know we're concerned about the zoo's accreditation. How far out is that whole process?
So we were hoping to put our best foot forward and try to apply sometime this year, and then we would know in 2020, I think at the mid-year meeting around spring,
okay,
if we got accredited or not, because they would come and inspect us sometime between November and maybe January. But we have to look at, you know, to make sure that we're ready, because we still have a lot of projects that we're undertaking.
Right.
But the zoo is looking good, and the staff works really hard to maintain standards. So.
Okay. All right. Well,
positive.
Good luck with that, and then good luck with finding our bird, our missing bird.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank
you so much, Linda.
Thank you.
That was Linda Santos, a Honolulu Zoo Director, talking about efforts to find the missing endangered bird, 13-year-old Najuma.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, announcing a science symposium for girls in grades 5 to 8, 7:45 a.m. this Saturday. Registration at sacredhearts.org.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we continue the conversation about homeless in Hawaii. We talk about the point in time count and new enforcement problems here in Hawaii. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.